Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 50. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of recent Australian science fiction movies. The first one is from 2013 and it's called These Final Hours. And the second one is the Sperry Brothers' latest effort, Predestination. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way and we will get on with the show. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. How is everybody going? We're doing okay here. Sal is still in hospital, probably until the 23rd, but I've got her out on a day pass at the moment, and she's sitting in the other room watching sitcoms. But anyway, thank you for all the good wishes that everybody has sent. And, yeah, we're getting through this, and it's all going to be fine. It's now the weekend before Newton Mass, of course. So I thought I would, as always, totally ignore the season and do whatever the fuck I like as far as a podcast is concerned. In this case, it's a couple more Australian genre films. Last time around, as you will recall, we did The Babadook, we being Kirsten McDermott and myself. And this time as well, we're doing two Australian genre films. Now, before I talk about the films themselves, I will talk a little bit about Australian genre films. But first I'm going to do, as always, the stuff I've been watching lately. Now, there have been a few genre films I've watched since last I spoke. One of them, I don't know, tell me if this you think this is a genre film or not. Chatterbox, the 1970s kind of sex comedy starring Candice Realson and a whole bunch of comedians and things like that. It's about a woman whose vagina suddenly gets a brain of its own and starts talking. It's a remake of an Alpha France French hardcore porn movie, but it's a little bit light and a little bit fun. I think I mentioned it last time around in Paleo Cinema, in fact. But, yeah, I liked it. I mean, I'm glad I got a copy of it in that sense. It's stupid and silly, very much of its time, and ridiculous. But it's a lot of fun, and it's one of those kind of not quite guilty pleasures. What's a better word than guilty for it? I'm trying to think. Well, one way or the other, it's a kind of gonzo pleasure of mine, so I enjoyed that. I did catch up with a movie which had a very difficult genesis in a lot of ways, and that's The Knights of Badassdom, starring Ryan Kwanten, Peter Dinklage, and Steve Zahn. Summer Glau's in it as well. About a whole bunch of LARPers who summon up a demon and have to deal with the consequences of that. Very gory in places. Not as funny as it should have been, but still, it harks back to a whole bunch of those 1990s and 1980s VHS kind of movies like Sorority Babes with the Slimeball Bolarama. It's got a little bit of that feel to it. Yeah, you know, summoning up demons and having to deal with them. Special effects are fairly good in the movie. And, yeah, I don't mind that I spent some time watching it. It's a bit silly, but not too bad at all. Picked it up really cheaply on Blu-ray because I went through the ex-rental Blu-rays at the one remaining DVD shop. DVD rental place in the area, and found that, and I thought, yeah, I'll throw a few bucks at it. It was just basically pocket change. So I kind of enjoyed that as well. I did see an old favourite, and in fact, I've got the Daybill poster for this particular movie hanging up on the wall in the kitchen living room kind of area.
of the house, and that is Blackula, starring William Marshall, which I enjoyed revisiting a lot. It's got the Hughes Corporation in it, the kind of 1970s disco band. It's so 1970s, kind of blaxploitation, special effects were very ropey, all that kind of gear. But I like it. Again, it's another one of those silly pleasure movies that I occasionally dip into. I do have it in a double DVD set with Scream, Blackula Scream, which is on my short list to watch. And, yeah, it was fun. William Marshall was great in the movie. He, Shakespearean-trained actor, of course, really, really a lot of gravitas to him, and he wanted to make the character a little more serious. So they gave him the backstory. The character's name is Mobawadi. They gave him a backstory of being an African prince who gets turned into a vampire and trapped for hundreds of years by Dracula himself, and ends up in L.A. In the 1970s. Yeah, it works. It works within the context of its time. It's a time capsule kind of exploitation movie in a lot of ways, but I think it's worth checking out, and a little bit of fun. It's got that really bright, not really bloody-looking blood to it. And, yep, and the women's clothing, the disco kind of gear and the women's clothing in particular, and the men's clothing for that matter, is really good. It's got a lot of black character actors from the time in it as well. Like, it's got Thelma Sreshalala. It's got G2 Kumbuka in it. It's very, very cool for that reason. Time capsule movie. And I also saw Kevin Smith's movie Tusk, which I think is really unfair, the fact that he turns a podcaster into a human walrus is a bit over the odds. But nonetheless, it's got Michael Parks in it. It's got Justin Long in it. It has Haley Joel Osment in it as well. And Johnny Depp having a bit of fun, and probably the most amusing Johnny Depp role in a while, given the fact that he made Transcendence. And pretty much anything else he made in the last number of years. But, yeah, I mean, low budget. It's got the exploitation stuff happening. It veers a little bit human centipede-y at times and brings the horror the way it should. Michael Parks, as always, is superb. He's come a long way since Then Came Bronson back in the 1960s. And, if you're kind of inclined to kind of gory and to some extent body horror films, it's worth checking out. It's not, some people say it's the best Kevin Smith movie for a number of years, but I think it's just a good, honest genre piece. Sets out a really absurd premise, somebody being caught by a madman and turned into a human walrus. And it really runs with the concept, and it follows it through to its logical and not very pretty conclusion. I think this one's going to be a sleeper, and I think it's definitely got cult film written all over it. Maybe that was the intention at the time it was made, but even so, I think it's definitely well entitled to being a cult film. So that's about all I've been watching. The other thing I should mention too is that I'm now doing video previews on YouTube for what's coming up on the podcasts. Well, some of the Patreon fund money I have invested in a high-end HD webcam, which I'm now fiddling with my hand. It's on an old microphone stand that I've got it mounted on to get it just to the right height. And I'm going to be putting like a little bits of the clips for various movies in and talking a little bit about them. Not too much, as a way of introing the movies that are coming for the podcasts. So look out for that. It'll be on the Paleo Cinema Cafe. It'll be on the Blogspot websites for the podcast as well, and it'll be on Facebook. So, yeah, stretching things out a little bit. I'm learning some rudimentary video editing, just using the Windows Video Maker software. I'm not going anything too fancy at the moment. But I'm enjoying the learning curve of that. It's not terribly different from audio editing, which I've kind of done for a fair bit now. But I do enjoy the fact of learning new things and putting together something, compiling it, uploading it to YouTube, and putting it out there for people to enjoy. So that's definitely something I want to continue with. What I'm also potentially looking at, and this does depend on time and motivation to a certain extent, is maybe doing some premium content that's only available to people who do the Patreon campaign. I was thinking of doing something like a locked YouTube video or something, some kind of video anyway that you can only access if you've got the password that I'll only be giving out to the Patreon people. And maybe doing a brief thing on reference books. So movie reference books I recommend. And just that, giving a little bit extra to the people who give a little bit extra, if you know what I mean. So I'll make people aware of that well ahead of time. And if you want to throw in $1 a month, we can maybe do that. Again, it does depend on time and motivation, but we'll see how we go with that anyway. So I'm going to take a break now. And in order to get with the season somewhat, I'm going to play a holiday tune. This one is very, very non-denominational and non-Christian, which for me works. And it is Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, with a very cool track. Last year I played another cool track, which was The Merriest with, Anita O'Day. But this time around, we're doing a track with Satchmo, and this track is called Cool Yule.
On the island to the Sunset Strip, somebody's gonna make a happy trip tonight while the moon is bright. He's gonna have a bag of crazy toys to give the gonies of the girls and boys. So day Santa comes on day, come a calling when the snow's the most, when all your cats are sleeping warm as toast. And you gonna flip when old Saint Nick lays a lick on a peppermint stick. You come a flying from a higher place and fill the stocking by the fireplace. So you have a youth that's Sunset Strip. Somebody's gonna make a happy trip tonight while the moon is bright. He's gonna have a bag of crazy toys to give the gonies of the girls and boys. So dig, Santa comes on big. Come calling when the snow's the most, cats are sleeping warm as toast. And you gonna flip when the old Saint Nick plays a lick on the peppermint stick. You come a flying from the higher place, fill the stockings by the fireplace. So you have a youth that's cool. Have a youth that's cool. Yeah, cool youth.
Yeah, that should perk you up a little bit. Yeah, Australian genre films. It's an interesting time for Australian genre films. Things are happening, which nobody expected. It didn't come out of anywhere. It just came out of the blue that suddenly there are a bunch of Australian genre films which are doing really well and which are showing a kind of similarity in some ways in that they are science fiction or fantasy or horror, but they're also deeply character-based, which is really, really interesting and really, really cool. And I hope it bodes well for the future. There are a number of them, of course, The Babadook being one, Predestination, which I'm going to talk about, being another, These Final Hours being another, The Infinite Man. There are a bunch of them either in production or just in post-production now. And so Australia suddenly is becoming an interesting place to be when it comes to genre cinema. And that's kind of cool. It's something we've waited for a long time. There were times when all we'd get are really shit things like The Time Guardian and other rubbish. But now it's getting to the stage where the special effects stuff is kind of fairly inexpensive to do. Sperry Brothers knew this in 2004 when they did the special effects for Undead, their first feature film, on a laptop. And again, it's maybe because budgets are fairly limited here and money's not easy to get for the funding of cinema, that there's a kind of spareness about the use of special effects in Australian genre films as they are now, but they're used to great effect. They're very targeted. They're very precise. They use them where it's going to do the most good. And the two movies I'm talking about today are very much demonstrations of that. I'm going to do them in chronological order, even though they're both within the last 18 months or so is when they've come out. The first one of these two is These Final Hours. I'm going to play some audio from the trailer, even though you may have seen it on YouTube, and then come back and tell you why you should see this film if you haven't already.
Is there anybody out there? It's happened. Approximate location of impact, the North Atlantic. As I speak to you right now, it's making its way towards our fair nation. We have 12 hours, people.
We're already dead. It's gonna hurt. And I don't wanna feel it. I don't wanna feel a thing.
I hope you're looking after yourselves out there and each other. These are things we gotta hold on to.
James.
Where are you going?
Party. Big party.
Maybe someone at the party can take me to Undead.
You brought a kid, James?
I came here because I didn't know what to do. I'm gonna take that girl back to where she belongs.
What about it? Where do you belong?
They said that God has a perfect plan for everyone.
Do you ever think you might end up in hell instead of heaven?
Are you trying to impress? Running around trying to help this girl?
Just trying to help her, Mum.
You better go.
How come you're not with her?
I've messed a lot of things up, Grace.
There's still time.
I just hope you're all keeping safe out there. You're surrounded by your families.
Hold on. Hold on, Rose.
It's coming.
Okay, so there it is. These Final Hours. Really interesting film for the initial premise, which is that an asteroid has struck the North Atlantic, as it says in the trailer. And all life on Earth is gone in 12 hours. No question about it. No fudging it. No getting Bruce Willis to split the asteroid. No escape to somewhere else. No digging a hole deep enough to save yourself. So that brings us to an important question in a film like this. What's at stake? What really matters when in 12 hours nothing will matter? And that's the crux of this film. The director, Zach Hilditch, I want to see more from Zach Hilditch. I think he did a fantastic job in this film. $2 million budget and some really, really fine acting, both from the adults, particularly Nathan Phillips, starring as James, the guy in the film, and also from Anguri Rice, who plays young girl called Rose who he rescues. So basically the plot of this one's pretty simple. The world's coming to an end. And a very self-centered guy called James is leaving his lover and going back to his girlfriend because his girlfriend's at the party to end all parties and he wants to go out with a bang at the most spectacular party in the history of Perth, which is the city in which the movie takes place. So he's making his way back across from the beachside house where he is with his lover to where his girlfriend is. Obviously, he's a bit versatile when it comes to personal relationships. So on his way there, his car gets stolen by a random guy. Things are breaking down. There are streets that are blocked by great big walls made out of shopping trolleys. There are people hanging from street lamps where they've hung themselves or been hung by somebody else. There are people beating each other up on the streets and people wandering around with Christian messages daubed on their clothing. Everything's broken down, and it's the middle of summer in Perth. It's hot, it's dry, and it's going to get a lot hotter when that wall of flame hits the city. So James is driving back, his car gets stolen, and as he's walking through the streets, he sees two older men dragging a young prepubescent girl into a house. He's ambivalent about it. He sees that they've just left the keys in their car, so he's thinking, I can pinch their car. But then he's about to just piss off and leave the girl there. 12 hours, it won't matter anyway. The moral compass is off kilter for everybody because anything you do won't matter by the time the sun goes down, because by the time the sun goes down, the human race is history. But he takes a chance. He enters the house and rescues the girl. That's a terrific scene, by the way. Really nice action scene, really tense, really ugly, but it works really, really well. So the girl's name is Rose. Her parents are religious. She wants somebody to take her to her father because her father promised her that they will be together at the end. James only wants to go to this party and see his girlfriend and just basically get totally shit-faced and see the end of the world that way. And he's incredibly ambivalent about taking on the responsibility of looking after Rose and trying to help her find her father. She thinks her father may be at her auntie's place, which is way out of James's way. And so ultimately he decides to take her to his sister's place, but they get to his sister's place and his sister has committed suicide and killed her family. He then takes her to the party. And we see the kind of party that James is going to go to and the kind of person he was up until the moment he met Rose. And that party's crazy. There's a big stage where guys are playing Russian roulette because it doesn't fucking matter anymore. There's an enormous orgy going on inside the house. There are people getting drunk and swimming in the enormous swimming pool. And he meets his girlfriend, Vicky, who is... she's one of those people that sets off all of the alarm bells. She's needy, she's neurotic, she's off her tits drunk, and she shows James a kind of panic room bomb shelter that her brother and her know is in the basement of the house. And James, of course, not being totally stupid, knows that it's not going to help at all, because unless you're a couple of kilometers below the surface of the earth, you're not going to survive this thing. Anyway, that's part of the setup of it. And basically, it's a redemption story. It's about James redeeming himself as a human being and doing the right thing when there is absolutely, positively, and entirely no reason to do the right thing. There are no consequences. The rule of law has broken down. In fact, he meets a police officer with his family in a library as they're traveling around. And this demonstrates just how far they are from the rule of law. And now this movie has a particular resonance at the moment too, because a couple of things have happened in Australia this week, one of them at least will have reached international news. And that was the siege in the middle of Sydney where an Islamic extremist who was basically mentally ill held a whole bunch of people hostage in a cafe, and during the rescue attempt, two of the hostages and the guy himself were killed. So there's that. Plus, there was the news yesterday that a woman in North Queensland killed 8 of her children and then tried to kill herself. Obviously, she had mental illness, and obviously she was desperate, but it kind of, when I was thinking about that and then thinking about this movie, it's kind, there's a resonance there and there's a despair there, which is palpable and which is very, very powerful. So, I mean, this isn't an incredibly good film, to be honest with you. It follows its conclusions logically. It shows the breakdown of the world with just a touch of special effects, that you see that the city of Perth, the CBD area, and the big buildings there are burning, so he doesn't want to go anywhere near there. And it gives an incredibly good sense of the suburbs emptying out as people either kill themselves or flee to some illusory place of refuge. It's basically a dying world in a lot of ways. And it's actually a shock when you come into the party scene and see just how many people there are at the party, because through the rest of the film, you see people in groups of 3 to 5 at the most and nothing in between. The streets are empty. There's no traffic around. It's a very, very spooky setting for this film. And really, for $2 million, this film is all of its money. It really is. It hasn't made much money yet. It did get a release in some cinemas, and it's been showing at a few film festivals, and it's got very, very good reviews. But it just hasn't made its money back yet. I do hope that it gets a release. It will be getting a DVD and a Blu-ray release here in Australia. And I do hope it gets a lot of publicity and gets a lot of legs overseas as well, because I want them to make the money back on this film. I think this film deserves to make a profit, and Zach Hilditch and his team really deserve to be rewarded for their effort and be rewarded for giving us a kind of, and it probably is a unique vision of the end of the world. There are a couple of other films that I've seen that deal with this kind of end of the world scenario, but they haven't done it in quite this way. The bottom line for this film is the characters. James is the kind of person that I don't really like as a person. He's self-centered. He's tattooed. He's likes to get drunk and get fucked up and stoned. He's all about himself and all about how he feels. And that's, again, the kind of character that I really, really don't like as a person. And the actor Nathan Phillips, Australian actor, in fact, he was born about, 35 kilometres away from where I'm sitting right now, in Sunbury, is really good in this. He does inhabit the character really well, and that redemptive arc of the character is portrayed very well. He's not particularly the sharpest pencil in the box. He's kind of out for himself. He doesn't mind playing his girlfriend off against the woman he really loves. He's basically, the end of the world is almost the perfect scenario for him, because he's dodged responsibility wherever possible. And this is a world where there's no point to responsibility. The only moral code there is that one you impose upon yourself. There's no rule of law. There's nobody looking over your shoulder. There's really no reason to be virtuous. Now, there are a bunch of religious people in this film, including Rose's parents, Rose's father in particular, who are religious, but the movie has a very secular bias in that way. It really isn't about, if this movie had been made in some other country, perhaps there would have been the redemptive arc of people going to heaven and stuff like this. But in the world posited by this movie, and it's not unaligned with my belief systems, the only meaning is the meaning you put into life. It's not something that you get rewarded for afterwards. There's no afterlife. There's no big God in heaven. There's none of that shit. What matters is what you do here and now. And that's the arc that James goes through as a character. And there are times when And the lovely thing about the way Nathan Phillips plays it and the way Zach Hurlich sets it up, there are moments when you think he's going to do the right thing, and there are moments when he does the wrong thing, particularly at the party when he takes Rose to the party. He doesn't continue that duty of care with her, and she becomes endangered by that in some very fucked up and serious ways. And the interesting thing about that is the person who endangers her in that scene is played by Sarah Snook, who plays one of the major roles in the second movie I'm going to talk about today, Predestination. She plays an incredibly complex role in that, and in this movie she plays a very, very, very different character, which if you see the two movies side by side, you just get an idea of the range of Sarah Snook as an actor. She is very, very good. Perth's a city I like a lot. I haven't visited there for a while, but I have been there maybe five or six times. It's the most isolated city of over 1 million people on the planet. It's hard to get there from here. It's expensive to get there from here, even though it's on the other side of the country. It's got a large British immigrant population because when the ships came over in the 1950s, 60s and 70s carrying British immigrants, a lot of them got fed up with being on the ship and just jumped off at the first port of call, which was Perth. So there's a lot of pommy stuff there. It's built in a lot of places on a lot of sand dunes. That's why they call them sand gropers over there. And it's still a vibrant city. It's got a great culture. The arts are very big over there. It's got a convict history. It's got a great sense of history as well. It's got Rottnest Island just off the coast. It's a really, really interesting town. If you ever get a chance to go there and you haven't, Perth is a very happening city. A little expensive at the moment because of the mining boom and price rises based on that. But it's definitely a place worth visiting. And I know many, many really good people over there who are fine and generous souls. They probably did cringe a lot when they saw their city just as the apocalypse is happening. But this movie really is mind-blowingly good for its money. And the redemption does pay out. I'll be honest with you, the redemption does pay out, but it doesn't pay out in a way that is kind of lip service-y or is just ticking the boxes. It's done in a realistic way, and it's done in a really nice way, and it's done with a lot of class. But having said that, I mean, let's compare that to a movie like, say, the new Mad Max film, which I've said a lot about and which I don't particularly approve of because it's taken away any cultural context to the movie. That's turned the apocalypse and turned the end of the world into spectacle. It's turned it into a kind of action film / video game. But this one, the heart and soul of this movie are the people and the characters and the way that some people find their best selves when there's absolutely no reason at all to do so. And that's kind of cool. This movie does say some things about being a human being, which I like. It says that, you know, there are times when you really need to just put your own shit aside and do the right thing. There's some other good actors in there as well. Lynette Curran playing James's mother has a few good scenes in there as well. She's really great in that. Lynette Curran's been an Australian actor for a long time. She started out doing, as everybody did in some ways, TV shows. She's one of the girls in that classic Australian exploitation film, Alvin Purple, as a young woman. And she does get a kid off in that. But in this one, she's an older woman, and she really does, you know, bring her A-game to the thing. There are lots of thing with Australia and with any kind of cinema anywhere. There are a lot of actors who have racked up a number of birthdays and who aren't young anymore. But when they're given the chance at a role, do it incredibly well. They're a resource undertapped in Australia. Male and female actors, I don't care. But particularly females who have such skill and tradecraft and artistry and maybe life experience that even in a small role like this, they're really, really good. I like Lena Curran in this film a lot, even though she does only have those two scenes. She is And she does help James along the way, even though she's been alienated from her son. They haven't seen each other for a long time. There's a nice sense of connection there, and there's a nice line of humour that runs through things, even though everything's gone to shit. And James does have to be the bearer of bad tidings to her. There are a couple of nice little bits of humour in that interaction, which I really like a lot. But anyway, there's not too much else to say about these final hours. I do like the poster art too. The poster art is very evocative and works well. You can find it on the Wikipedia page. In fact, I might put it up on martiandrivein.blogspot.com because I really like that artwork. But this movie, I mean, I want to see more Australian genre films like this and more Australian films as well. I really think that we're onto something here as a nation and as a culture. And I really want to encourage movies like this and like The Babadook and like Predestination and genre films as well. In genre fiction, in written genre fiction, Australia is punching above its weight already. We do have an incredibly rich culture of horror and science fiction and fantasy writers in this country. Kirsten McDermott, whom I had on the last podcast, being a very good example. But it's nice now to see that flowing over into cinema. And I want to see more of it. And I encourage people to go out there and see The Babadook and see These Final Hours and see The Infinite Man, see any Australian genre film you can, because you're helping us. You're helping us bring interesting cinema to the world, and you're helping good people get rewarded for their efforts. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. And when we get back, we're going to a very different genre film, Predestination by the Sperry Brothers, starring Ethan Hawke and Sarah Snook, based on the Robert Heinlein short story, All You Zombies. Be back in a little bit.
They say the world don't have heroes anymore. Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi there. This is Roger Ward, Fifi for Mad Max, and you're listening to Martian Drive-In. Enjoy, babies.
What if I could put him in front of you, the man that ruined your life? If I could guarantee that you'd get away with it, would you kill him?
Many New Yorkers are leaving the city in fear of a fifth attack by the Fizzle Bomber.
Maybe he's doing the city a favor.
That kind of talk can get you in trouble.
The worst that I've already been through.
There's something this job has taught me, is that truth is stranger than fiction.
You're not talking about bartending, are you?
I'm not talking about bartending.
Follow me right in here. Here we go. Deep breath.
We're in 1963.
That's impossible.
I'm a temporal agent. We prevent crime before it takes place.
The Fizzle Bomber. His next explosion will leave 11,000 dead.
You can do this.
Right.
You have skills you've never had the chance to use, and I can give you that chance.
I get to be a temporal agent?
If you prove yourself.
Do I have a choice?
You always have a choice.
10, 9.
I always knew something was different about me.
You're a gift given to the world through a predestination paradox. You're the only one.
You're gonna save millions of lives.
You must complete your mission. You must lay the seeds for the future.
Here you are, at the beginning of your new life.
I know where I come from. Where do all you zombies come from?
You're here to create history and influence wise to come.
Time catches up with us all.
The path you're on will take you to your destination.
Okay, there's a spoiler alert all over Predestination when I talk about it here, so just be aware of that. If you haven't seen the movie and you haven't read the Robert Heinlein story, All You Zombies, then go and do both of those things and then come back, okay? Fair enough. You've been warned. Okay, so Michael and Peter Spurek, who started out hitting our radar in 2004 with Undead, a nice little zombie movie. Then they moved on to Daybreakers, a nice little vampire movie. And now they've gone on to Predestination, a nice little time travel movie. This cast is pretty much Ethan Hawke, Sarah Snook and Noah Taylor. It was filmed down at Docklands Studios in Melbourne, which is about a bit less than a kilometre away from where I work. And, yeah, basically the story is fucked up. I was trying to find a pricey for it somewhere. Give me a moment. I'm going to find a pricey for this, which I want to give you before I start doing the spoilers. Okay, scrub that idea because it didn't work. There's no good pricey of this on the internet. Now, this is the same line that starts the Sydney Morning Herald review of the movie. But I came up with it just before I just looked at the Sydney Morning Herald review of the movie. A guy walks into a bar. It's in 1975 in New York City. The guy that walks into a bar writes confessional tales about pregnant, unmarried mothers and things like that for a newspaper and magazines. And he meets the bartender, and the bartender says, oh, yeah, I read some of your stuff. It's pretty good. And then a bet forms, and the unmarried mother guy decides to have a bet with the bartender that his story is the strangest one the bartender's ever heard. Now, this movie takes place in an alternate universe. It's nothing like our history. The story was written in 1958, published in 1959 by Robert A. Heinlein, one of the big names in science fiction. His work has been reevaluated and seen to be pretty much middle 20th century sexist, and his later work is very much discredited, but he was incredibly influential in the genre. We've got to respect him if not for his sexual politics. Basically, the guy tells his story. He was born in an orphanage as a woman and grew up as a woman and tried to join the Women's Auxiliary of the Space Corps when he grew up. He was born in 1945, but failed at that because of some irregularities physiologically, and ended up becoming a home help person and studying at night. He fell in love with a mystery man, got pregnant to that man, and then had a child. When the child was born by cesarean section, they found out that actually this person, who is known as John Doe, was intersex, and having the child had messed up all the female reproductive organs. There were both kinds of reproductive organs in there, both immature, but the female organs were mature enough to allow her to have a child. But in having the cesarean, they had to remove the female organs, and that then started the process of Jane, as she was then, becoming John, the man, and changing gender. Now, that's a fairly good story, but that's only the first part of it as well. It then becomes the fact that John is recruited by the bartender, played by Ethan Hawke, into becoming a temporal agent, a time-traveling policeman in a sense. In the 1970s, there's a spate of bombings by somebody called the Fizzle Bomber, and the job of the temporal agency is to stop the Fizzle Bomber. Now, that's where things become really fucked up, because the time-traveling bartender takes John Doe back in time, where he falls in love with Jane and impregnates her to have a child. That child is then kidnapped by the bartender and taken back to 1945 and left outside an orphanage. So John Doe / Jane is a person who doesn't have a past. She is their own. He and she are its own parents. John, gender is mixed up in this thing, as you can tell from the way I'm mixing it up there. But there's another couple of steps too, but I won't do a total spoiler on this film, except to say that Heinlein's story does have some interesting curves in. And the interesting thing, I just actually, in between talking about these final hours and talking about this movie, I reread All You Zombies, the short story by Heinlein. And it's amazing how close the movie stays to it within the limitations of the passage of time and the change of media. But the Sperry Brothers, of course, do a lovely line that they are incredibly good at genre work. I want to see them do more films. In 10 years, they've done 3 movies, but that's more to do with funding and those kind of problems. But they do this one really well. It's the second movie they've done with Ethan Hawke after Daybreakers. And the unmarried mother is played by a fine Australian actor who has only just pinged on my radar. And her name is Sarah Snook, who is also one of the characters in These Final Hours. But in this one, she plays both genders. She plays the unmarried mother and she plays Jane. Now, as a male, she does look transgendered. She looked kind of, but also she kind of looks like, to my eyes at least, a young DeForest Kelly. So she kind of plays it like that, and with a little bit of Carl Urban thrown in there just to fuck things up a little bit. But, yeah, basically the movie is fine, and it's one of those ones that kind of rides a razor's edge. This is a story of somebody who doesn't have a past, in a sense, doesn't have ancestors, doesn't have descendants. In fact, they are their own descendant, which genetically doesn't work, but for the purposes of telling a time travel story is very, very interesting. And the other knife edge that this movie rides to is gender politics. I've heard a couple of people complain about the way that transgender people are treated in the movie, but I've only heard just a little bit. I don't know whether transgender people will be offended by it. I know a few transgendered people in the science fiction community, and whether they'd be offended by having this particular Heinlein story adapted, I don't know. I could ask, but I'm not going to. For me, it works as a story, and I think that Sarah Snook portrays the character really well. The kind of wide-eyed innocence of Jane as a character, her upbringing in the orphanage and her trying to get ahead in the world as a woman in quite a sexist time period. And then after being left by her lover, who she doesn't know is herself, having a child, and then finding out that the process of having a child has reassigned her gender. And Sarah Snook plays that really well, that kind of horror and tragedy and toughness to get through that kind of stuff is carried across really well in the film. And the movie hinges on that quality of acting that Sarah Snook brings to it. I mean, Ethan Hawke's in there playing the bartender and, to be honest with you, a couple of other characters. And he is quite good at it, but Sarah Snook is the emotional heart of the movie and the core of it. And I think she does it really, really well. It's a bold movie to make because if you make love to yourself, is it incest or is it masturbation? You've got a lot of those kind of questions that come up with this kind of thing when you time travel, and the gender reassignment thing just making it even more complex. There's a good sense of period in there. There's a couple of scenes in an antique shop, which is kind of cool, and there are typewriters around and all sorts of other things like that. The bar scenes are really effective, and they actually do reference a song which is mentioned in the original Robert A. Heinlein story, and which is quite apt to the theme of the movie and the theme of the story as well. I'm being a little vague on that because I want people to discover it for themselves. But again, this is a bold movie to make, and the Sperry Brothers did have trouble with the script as well. It's not something that lends itself easily to being changed into a script. There are things you've got to tweak and things you've got to expand upon, and to make this work as a feature film, the fact that she's becoming a part of the female auxiliaries of the Space Corps and in essence being a kind of comfort woman to males who are on long space trips is mentioned quite a short part of the short story, but it's fleshed out a lot in the movie of necessity as well, that that kind of innate sexism that women could be only a comfort to men on long space trips rather than crew members with their own needs and own agendas. And professionalism is something that's not really addressed in the story, because it is quite a short story and it was written in 1958, but does get an airing and does get recognition and does get acknowledgement in the film. We live in an entirely different era to 1958. I know I've lived through it all, but I think the Sperry brothers do handle that quite well. But the thing is that they could have picked, I mean, there's a lot of genre works out there to pick from, particularly short stories, and short stories adapt themselves to movies a lot better than novels do, because with a short story, you've got a fairly straightforward plot line. And the structure of a short story is more similar to the structure of a screenplay than is the structure of a novel. But in this case, the Sperry brothers didn't take the easy option. They could have picked any number of Heinlein stories. There are a whole bunch of them that would have worked as films and may still do in the future. But they decided to really take on one of the harder chores, which is this one with the recursive timelines and the temporal paradoxes and the innate impossibility of their main character being quite core to this. And I like that. I like the fact that they decided to bite off more than they could chew and then chew it. That really does work for me. And I can see about five or six different places in this story where it could have seriously fucked up, where it could have derailed itself, and where in some instances a movie might not have ever been completed. But they did, and it does work as a film. It's a lot unlike a lot of other time travel movies. Even though you've got recursive timelines and people going back and meeting themselves and things like that, there's not a story that's taken it to this kind of conclusion, at least in cinema form, before. And I like that. And I also like the extra steps. I mean, I read the story. I read it maybe four times over the years, and I knew what was coming up all through the movie. But having said that, I don't mind that. I went along for the ride. I went along to see how they would do it as much as to enjoy the story itself. It's that extra kind of layer of things that I've mentioned before being one of the fun things in movies. The more you know, the more fun there is, and the more you can kind of see behind the curtains, in a sense. And I think that this works quite well for that. There are lots of small cool bits in this film too. The production design is really good, particularly on the training that Jane does to go into space, which she unfortunately never gets to do. There's a kind of really interesting Art Deco look to the design, mixed with a 1960s Pan Am aeroplane kind of design. There's the lovely conceit. They don't mention in a lot of detail how the time travel machine works in the short story. There's something about throwing a metal net down and then having the net swallow up the people that want to time travel. But in this case, they went with another conceit, which was to make the time travel device a violin case with a combination lock on it. And the combination lock is set up with the little twirling dials, the same way combination locks are, to show the date that you want to travel to. And then you just flip this, the latch on the violin case to set the thing off. And that's kind of cool too, because it's something that people do carry around. And it's also something that's got an innate sense of menace because of the old trope about machine guns being in violin cases. But that kind of works nicely as well. There can be some argument about the additions that the Sperry brothers do to the original short story, particularly at the end, where one of the characters meets himself again in a laundrette. But I think it works cinematically to bring things around. It adds just a little more wonder and mystery to the story and to the characters involved. That works for me. I think that's an addition that kind of fleshes out and completes the short story in some way and takes it in a new direction, but not in an inconsistent direction to the way the plot of the story is. So, you know, kudos to the Sperry brothers for that. Now, again, this is a movie that hasn't made a lot of money. It was a lot more expensive than... it doesn't matter. This movie costs about six or eight times as much as These Final Hours. Both fine films anyway. By the way, I misspoke earlier when I said that Jane / the unmarried mother was transgendered. In fact, she was intersex. So I apologize for that nomenclatural error. Now, the other thing that this movie brings up too is something that I only just found out the name for, because I'm slow on these things, and that is what they call a bootstrap paradox or an ontological paradox. So, ontological paradox is this. I go back in time and give myself a wristwatch. Then I travel normally through, just say I go back a year in time and give myself a wristwatch. Then I have the wristwatch for a year, and then I go back in time and give it to myself. Where did the wristwatch come from? That's the question. Now, there's a whole bunch of ways that it could happen. It depends on the timelines involved. But basically, the wristwatch doesn't have an origin point. And that's the thing with Jane / the unmarried mother. There is no origin point for that character. And that is something that fucks up the head of researchers who are studying time travel as a something in physics, that they don't understand where stuff comes from if you do that kind of thing. It really is messed up, and people posit various resolutions to it, that there was an original timeline when you had the wristwatch until you got into the time machine and went back a year and gave it to yourself, but then that would change the timeline and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, this movie does address that stuff in an interesting way. Again, it's a time travel movie that's unlike other movies, just in the same way that These Final Hours is somewhat different from other movies showing the end of the world. And I like that. I like the fact that they, in the case of These Final Hours, has a very Australian viewpoint on it, which is quite important too. It's something embedded in certain aspects of our culture and certain ways of doing things in Australia. But in Predestination's case, it's an international movie more than anything else, and definitely plays that way. In fact, the only real Australian movie in any way the Sperry Brothers did was their first one, Undead, which was set in Queensland, and since then they've decided, in order to get an international audience, they have to tell stories that do have that kind of Americanized look to them, and Americanized feel to them, and Americanized accents to them as well. And, you know, who's to say it doesn't work for them? I think there's room for both in genre works, but I do like to occasionally hear my own kind of accent in a science fiction or a fantasy or a horror movie. It just focuses things for me just that little bit better. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and after that, I've got a bit of feedback.
Preacher with the Atom Frame, a motion picture shot full of thrills based on scientific facts described in leading national magazines.
You'll be hypnotized.
You'll be terrorized.
You'll be paralyzed.
See a dead man come from beyond the grave. See Columbia Pictures startling Preacher with the Atom Frame.
And we did get some feedback from our old friend Morris from over at Love That Album Podcast. Morris says, "Hey Terry, my apologies for not having sent this in time for Paleo Cinema 150, but at least it's there in time for Martian Drive-In 50, and pretty much covers my sentiments for both podcasts. As I may have told you previously, Paleo is not my first podcast. This was the British horror podcast, Mondo Movie. But it is the show I've listened to the longest. When Dan and Ben retired Mondo Movie for the first time, I desperately searched for something to replace my craving for film discussion in this wonderful podcast medium. Google turned up Paleo Cinema, so my first episode was episode 69, Alvin Purple. When I saw that was your selection. I just knew this was a show for me and have been a fan ever since. I dig your approach to film. It's intelligent and well thought out without being dryly academic. You make many interesting diversions to think on a more broad world perspective, which is what great films are trying to do anyway. A good example of this was your recent episode on The Intruder with William Shatner. Your digressions to discuss bigotry in various forms was a natural enhancement to the discussion of the trajectory of the film. Of course, you also brought well-thought-out analysis on the various character arcs, which made me want to search out the film, which I did and claim it in my top 10 first-time watches for the year. Of course, the outside perspective is also a good one, and your recent chat on MDIP with Kirsten on the Babadook brought out more things for me to think about this wonderful movie, and I blow a big raspberry to its detractors. Sorry about this, guys. I'm so glad that podcasting is your passion, so I will always have something to listen to from Paleo Studios. Well done, Terry, on having recorded 200 episodes of podcasts and on however many appearances on the ABC Northern Territory. Cheers, Morris. Thanks, Morris, and I think it's my turn to share coffee next time. Thank you very much. I'm not sure how many times I've been on ABC Northern Territory. I know I've been doing it for 5 years with about a five-month hiatus in the middle there, apart from, like, Christmas, New Year times. But, thank you for that. I do try to bring a little bit more to the plate than just a dry thing about the movie, because that's how I think about them. I think about movies in a context, in a social context sometimes. And it's not always apt to do that. I mean, if I was going to do something like, I don't know, Tusk or Blackula, there wouldn't be too much social context, though I'm sure I could find something. Anyway, Morris, happy Hanukkah, dude. And I will talk to you in the new year. And that's about it for this time around, people. So everybody, enjoy the holidays, whatever you do with them and whatever you call them. Whether you're religious, secular, or from another planet, doesn't matter. Just hug the people you love, enjoy yourselves, eat too much food, but don't feel too guilty about it afterwards because you're supposed to. And for the people who are doing a bit rough this time of year, all my very best wishes. I hope that next year gets better for you if this year's a little bit rough. And I know that things change and sometimes they get better. So take care of yourselves. And remember that people do care. Anyway, that's about it. And of course, as usual, the credits are going to roll now in the style of movie credits. For everybody who supported the Patreon campaign, you go to patreon.com/paleocinema and throw me a penny now and then and I'll dance for you like a monkey. So take care and I'll catch you later. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.